I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. It's a great joy and pleasure and honor today to welcome Dr. Rowan Williams to Conversing. He has formerly served as the Archbishop of Canterbury from 2002 to 2012, and he currently serves as the Master or President of Magdalen College at the University of Cambridge in England. Welcome to Conversing.
Thank you very much indeed.
Dr. Williams is on campus at Fuller in part because of a lecture series that we call the Peyton Lectures, an annual lecture series. And we are working him hard through a number of different venues, but I'm very grateful for the chance to have this conversation with you. Tell us, for starters, I know that you were raised in Wales and you're the first Welsh bishop to become an Archbishop of Canterbury. Mm. So tell us a little bit about your spiritual background and what formed you early on in your life.
Growing up in Wales meant, in those days, in the 50s, growing up in a very distinctive nonconformist Protestant environment. And I spent a lot of my childhood in a Presbyterian Sunday school. It wasn't until I was about 11 that my family joined the Anglican Church.
I see, right.
So I have Presbyterian blood in me.
It's good blood.
So they tell me. And that meant, of course, a tradition which valued hymn singing, preaching, and biblical education. I think what we were taught in Sunday school in the 1950s really did shape my future in all kinds of ways.
Mm. That's fascinating. Then how did you eventually come to a spiritual vocation, the belief that you should go into the ordained ministry?
It goes back almost as far as I can remember, in fact. I remember as quite a small boy when I was about 9 or 10 thinking perhaps the future would be, you know, as a minister in some way. And partly because I had immensely wise, encouraging, positive pastors in those years. That was gently nourished and pressed forward. And although I had moments of thinking, well, why? Or is this a good idea after all? I think during my teenage years particularly, a couple of moments where I felt my faith had really been rekindled, reanimated, just confirmed that. Mm. And bit by bit, it bedded in and became a very clear sense of calling.
Right. Can you share any of those stories about things that were a kind of reawakening moment for you?
One that I remember very particularly was when I was, I think, about 16, 17. And we had a visit in Swansea, which is the town where I grew up, from a man called Richard Wurmbrand, whose name will be familiar to quite a lot, I think. Romanian Lutheran pastor who'd been in prison for many years in communist Romania. And he was speaking at a tiny little Congregationalist church on the outskirts of Swansea, and some of my school friends said, want to come along and listen. And I think for the first time I encountered somebody for whom discipleship to Christ was a hugely costly thing, who had preserved his spirit of forgiveness, who had preserved his joy and his hope. And he spoke in a way that I'll never forget to the end of my life about what he'd suffered for the gospel and the joys of it. And his books, Tortured for Christ and Sermons in Solitary Confinement, became very treasured spiritual reading for me. That was one of those moments where I just thought, well, you know, maybe this really is true after all. It's not just talking
right.
about it.
It suddenly expands, enlarges, deepens the implications of the whole faith tradition.
Yeah. And right at the other end of the spectrum, as you might say, an experience again in my teens when I went for the first time to a Russian Orthodox service. And it was there the sense of the overwhelming majesty and beauty and glory of God, which just flooded me as I took part. And again, the feeling came through, this is real, this is not just words. And if it is real, it has a claim.
Right. So where along the way, maybe it was that moment that you moved gradually from Presbyterianism toward Anglicanism?
We'd moved house when I was 11 years old. We moved to another town, and there wasn't a Presbyterian church locally that seemed to have anything like the kind of vigor that we'd been used to. And we ended up in the local Anglican parish church, where the teaching and the preaching, the music, the whole culture of the church was just massively nourishing. Mm. And I've often said that one of the greatest blessings of my life was to have a pastor in those difficult teenage years who constantly made me and my friends feel that Christian faith enlarged your world rather than shrinking it.
Yes, yes.
When you went to church, when you listened to this particular priest preaching, you had a sense being Christian takes you into a bigger universe. Mm-hmm. No sense of awkwardness, anxiety, mm-hmm. a sort of pinched approach to the world. He was somebody who was very well-read, very compassionate and sensitive, and had the rare gift of taking young people absolutely seriously, however difficult and obnoxious we were, however many awkward questions we asked.
Right.
He just, you know, patiently nodded you through it, talked you through it, prayed you through it.
I think how different that story is to so many stories, sadly, of people who encounter religious authorities of one kind or another and who find that they shut the universe down rather than open it up.
Yeah. That's right. And years later, I had the rather sad privilege of taking this priest's funeral when I was a bishop. And somebody said to me on that occasion, somebody who'd been in the choir with me as a teenager, I hope, she said, that our children have somebody who can do for them what Eddie did for us when we were teenagers.
Wow. That's a great witness. Mm. So you go on with your education. Mm-hmm. Now, tell me, where along the way did you discover that you had a gift for language? You are a person who knows many languages, and it's one of the things that people have often commented about you and your scholarship and the capacity that you bring to the task of theology. But where along the way did that emerge for you, that you realized it?
I suppose quite early on in my secondary schooling. Growing up in a household where Welsh was spoken quite often as well as English. Not that I was brought up in Welsh, but it was spoken to the older generation and my parents would speak it to each other.
Right.
There was always the feeling that there was another way of saying things.
Right.
And that just made me fascinated with language from early on. So I devoured French and Latin as a schoolboy and just became very enthusiastic for learning languages.
Right, right. Which you certainly have gone on to learn many more than just those.
I learned them, a lot of them, rather badly.
One of the things that I'm struck by because of being in the role of serving as a president of a theological seminary is being aware of people at an intersection in their life where they're trying to understand and discern vocation. And vocation, obviously, from a Christian point of view, encompasses all of life, not just a vocation to a certain kind of job or let alone a certain kind of ecclesiastical job. But thinking of that season of discernment and vocation, you had emerging faith, growing passion, delight, and gratitude for the church and its ministry in your life. And yet you also came to a crossroads, presumably of some kind, where it became clear, I really do want to go on with this in a formalized way. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I suppose for the first half of my 20s, I was still turning this over a bit. It still seemed pretty clear that I was being nudged towards, at the very least, testing my calling. But I was also discovering academic work in a new way. There was doctoral research to pursue in theology. And for a bit, I wasn't completely sure. And I also wondered at that point whether I ought to test my calling as a monk, because I wanted time and space for prayer and growth with God at that level. So I guess the thing that finally tipped the balance was the sense that, awkward to talk about it in some ways, but quite a lot of people were asking me for support and counsel and companionship. And I felt very strongly, well, that's actually where something in me is being brought alive by other people asking for my prayer or my being alongside them in trouble. And I thought, well, maybe that's something to do with God nudging me over the line and saying, now it's time to ask the church, is this a right discernment?
Right. Were there certain people that you were in conversation with at that time that further confirmed this, I assume? Or
quite a lot, yes. I'd started teaching theology by the time I was 25, 26. People I was working with would dig me in the ribs and prod me about this. And also, I think I had a sense with some of my students who were preparing for ordained ministry. Well, if it makes sense for them, perhaps it makes sense for me. People I admired among my students. And that's a wonderful thing, isn't it? Where you can admire your students.
Indeed.
And I've often been greatly blessed with that recognition.
Right.
Yeah. I thought, well, yes, they're managing their integrity and their intelligence and their compassion in this direction. And perhaps I shouldn't just hang around waiting for voices from heaven, but go and ask, is this right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Go and ask people I trust.
Right, right. Well, I think one of the things that I've admired about you from a distance has been the combination of scholar, pastor, theologian that you've been so good at holding together as themes of a ministry that sometimes are seen as polarized in various needless ways. Again, it's part of the small making as opposed to the universe opening kind of vision. So. But it's also a capacity to be able to hold on to several things, each with their own particular contribution, and also to see them married in a way that can have its own integrity. Can you talk about how that happens? Because I think right now, especially, there's always been a theme in the United States, as you know, of popular Christianity in America being highly susceptible to a sort of anti-intellectualism that polarizes faith over and against a life of the mind. Mm-hmm. And clearly one of the things that you've been seeking has been to not only practice, but to give great evidence to the flourishing of how those things can be combined. Mm-hmm. How do you understand that?
Mm. If you read the Gospel of John carefully, one of the things that comes through is that truth is good for you. Truth nourishes you. So trying to discover and to understand more deeply the things of God, trying to immerse yourself in the depths of scripture and tradition is something that, again, enlarges your humanity. Mm-hmm. It gives you a perspective on who you are and who your neighbor is and who God is. And that's why I think anti-intellectualism is a sad thing. That's quite different from saying many people understand the gospel far more deeply than any intellectual would without any intellectual training.
Right.
Of course they do.
Right.
Heavens, yes. But if you've got that gift, if you've got that opening, well, presumably God wants you to use it and to use it for the well-being of your Christian neighbor.
Right.
So the sense of exhilaration that can come when you're trying to understand the teachings of the faith more deeply, that I think came alive for me very much in my time as a student of theology. And again, thinking back to particular moments, my third year as an undergraduate in Cambridge, just walking down a street in Cambridge one day, and feeling something I was reflecting on for an essay that I was writing just clicked. I thought, oh, yes. And of course, that's that's something about God. That's something I need to know.
Yes, yes.
And wanting to share that sense of exhilaration, I think, has a lot to do with why I've wanted to go on being a theologian.
Right. I do think that that kind of epiphany, the feeling that pieces are fitting and that there's a sense of, whether it's something we would dare to call revelation or not, nevertheless, a sense of a dawning, an awareness, a realization, an insight, it is an extraordinarily transporting experience. And when it can bring the totality of what you may be able to experience together, it's a very remarkable thing.
Yes, it all joins up.
Right.
It all joins up. And I think one of the things which sometimes in contemporary Christianity we lack is that sense of a big picture where all these elements, all these personal stories, all these aspects of scripture and Christian teaching all connect. That's a great moment which we need to prepare people for.
Yes, yes. So you had and have had a flourishing academic life and a flourishing pastoral life. And by the time you're appointed to be the Archbishop of Canterbury in 2002, you enter into a completely different role in some ways, and yet in other ways, a role that has great continuity with what you had been doing before. I'm not sure that everyone that may be listening to this broadcast understands what an Archbishop of Canterbury means and what the difference is between that and
something
a pope.
I'm not sure I do either.
It's the sign that you've actually been one.
Well, the Archbishop isn't a pope in the sense that the Archbishop is not any kind of chief executive in the Anglican family of churches. The Archbishop is the person who happens to be the senior bishop of the Mother Church of the Anglican Communion. So a great deal of the Archbishop's work is simply calling people together, getting them to discuss and talk and explore together, to give encouragement and support to churches across the world that are perhaps under pressure, to try and represent the Christian voice in British society a bit. It's quite a mixture of jobs. Somebody said there are seven distinct jobs that an Archbishop has to do. And he has to do it with the staff, as, again, somebody once said, the staff of a head teacher in a secondary school.
Yes.
So a mixture of things, but certainly not the kind of office where you can dictate the rules of the church, where you can change what the church says at will, and not a position like that of the Pope, where you are the final court of appeal.
Right.
So nebulous in some ways.
Right. I wanted to identify that in part because I would love to have you explore with us a little bit more about what the experience of being Archbishop during your period of service really meant. Because part of what I understand from the outside as a non-Anglican is the enormous complexity that was happening in the Anglican Communion during the time that you were serving, and the fact that the role that you occupied gave it prominence and significance of a unique kind, but not final authority. And that was all a piece of how the story unfolds. So give people a little bit of a background and then narrate a bit how your season as Archbishop unfolded.
The Anglican Communion is a fellowship of nearly 40 independent local churches. The numerical strength is mostly in Africa. People don't always realize just how large we are in Africa, but growing communities also in East Asia, South Asia, even Latin America. And the Church of England remains technically the mother church of all these, but is just one church among many. So where you have conflict within or between these local churches, it's quite difficult to know what the best means is to resolve that conflict. Now, I inherited a situation where we were already moving quite rapidly towards a very bitter and polarized discussion about sexuality and the possibility of ordaining people in same-sex relationships to the priesthood or ordaining them as bishops. And that was a question on which I had my own views and was inclined to think that perhaps we should relax our rules a bit. But as Archbishop, of course, I had to speak not just for myself or my own views or even for my own local church, but to try and help the discernment of the entire worldwide family. And when different bits of that family didn't very much want to talk to each other, that was rather hard work. So the standoff between particularly the Episcopal Church in the United States and some of the African parts of the family became at times very hard to manage. They wouldn't sit down at the same table with each other. And I had to find ways of trying to keep the conversation going, trying at times to say to people, you can break a church very quickly, but you can't put it back together very quickly. Therefore, be very careful about tearing up the fabric. Saying, which is, I suppose, the most important thing to me about the church, it's not my church or yours, it's God's. And therefore, we need to give each other a certain amount of space and time in dealing with these controversial things. All of that certainly was quite burdensome. And I was traveling regularly every year to different parts of the communion. And that, I suppose, gave me a certain sense of close-up feeling for how churches were.
Awareness and empathy.
Yes, a certain amount of empathy. And again, a great gift to see how people were coping with being Christian in what were often nightmare situations. In some parts of Africa, like Nigeria, you would have the conflict in some areas with militant Islam. In South Sudan, you had the civil war ongoing. In Melanesia and the Solomon Islands, one of my first visits abroad, they were just recovering from a murderous civil war there. And just seeing how people were coping under pressure. I went to Pakistan, I remember, about 12 years ago, just after there'd been a major massacre of local Christians. And isolated churches, minority churches, needed that connection with the worldwide church in some way. And one reason I suppose I was so insistent that we try and hold together was that awareness that these little churches struggling in very hostile circumstances really needed the rest of us. And we had to be aware of the pressures they were working under. So a privilege and a burden at the same time.
Yes, yes.
But you come away from these visits, and I really do want to share one particular story with the sense of having seen the gospel at work. I was in the Solomon Islands. It was a year after the civil war had finished. I'd been into prison in Honiara in the Solomon Islands to meet one of the rebel militia leaders who'd been responsible for all sorts of atrocities. I'd dedicated a memorial to seven people who'd been butchered in the civil war, members of the Melanesian Brotherhood, which was a great evangelistic group in the islands. And I went to the island of Malaita in the Solomons and celebrated Holy Communion in a football field for most of the population of the island. It was a great event. But over lunch afterwards, the premier of the island, the chief minister, came across to me and said, we've just had a civil war, and everybody in this island thinks it was the fault of the people on the other island, in Guadalcanal. Now, you know and I know that it's never like that. So he said, what I'm going to do is I am going to kneel down in the middle of the football field and say to you, on behalf of the people of this island, I confess that we were responsible for the Civil War, just like our neighbors across the Straits. Mm. And I want you to give us your blessing. Mm. And I thought, what an extraordinary gospel moment.
Absolutely.
That was.
Remarkable.
And how many political leaders would do that, would stand up in front of their own population and say, you know, we are guilty too in this.
Right.
We need God's grace and forgiveness.
Right.
Never forgotten that moment.
Right. Can you tell us how that was responded to when that actually then happened?
With great warmth. Mm. People felt, I think, that he was doing for them what needed to be done.
Right.
That something deeply gospel-shaped had happened.
Amazing. Mm. This is not necessary, but I'm curious, did the other island respond in any similar or parallel way?
Not that I recall.
Yes, right.
Can't win them all.
Exactly, exactly. But it is so profound that it happened in the way you described. It's really quite remarkable.
I preached about that several times.
I can imagine. Archbishop.
And that was another thing. You could come back from these visits knowing that there were things you had to share with people. And usually for the great festivals at Christmas and Easter, when I'd be preaching a sermon in Canterbury Cathedral, I would have something that I'd want to bring back from conversations and encounters.
Yes.
And say there in Canterbury with the cameras and lights of British media, there's a chance to say something on behalf of people otherwise silenced.
Right.
We had a very difficult few years when our church in Zimbabwe was under great pressure from Robert Mugabe, former President Mugabe, as I'm happy to call him.
Yes, indeed.
And I'd been in touch quite regularly with the bishops and people there and eventually went over to visit. But I made a point at the festivals of trying to be in touch with the bishops in Zimbabwe so that I could say from the pulpit of Canterbury Cathedral, your brothers and sisters in Zimbabwe send you their love and prayers and they will need to know that you are praying for them.
Yes, yes, yes. I do think that that's one of the markers to me of your leadership has been this insistence and desire, deep desire to hold uncommon things together and to be able to find places of connection and interrelationship and communion that really only Jesus Christ can actually sustain and create, but which you want to bear witness to both in systemic and in personal and interpersonal sorts of ways. And I often used to watch or read the accounts of various Anglican gatherings and the torturedness of the conversations and the difficulties and hostilities that you could feel. Tell us, when you're right in the middle of that vortex and you are seeking, as I take it that you are, seeking to be a genuine peacemaker in the midst of that, what are the resources of heart and mind and spirit that you're trying to draw from in order to live into that kind of a moment?
Mm-hmm. You need to know that people are praying for you. You need to make the space every day to be there for God. And I used to find at these meetings it helped to have some reading or study with me that just took me out of the controversy and back to basics.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I can't remember when exactly it was, 2006 or 7, we had a quite difficult meeting in Dar es Salaam in Africa. And Lent was just beginning, and I took with me one of my favorite books of spiritual reading, which is the letters of Abbot John Chapman, letters about prayer from a Roman Catholic monk to some of his friends in the early 20th century, a book that I've read, I don't know, probably 20 times. And just having that to hand every day and being able to come back from a tense and ill-tempered meeting and just open that and get back to basics and think, well, this is what it's for. This is what it's for.
Mm-hmm.
And the knowledge that people were praying didn't exactly make it easy, but you knew that it had all been committed to the only power that can make a difference.
Right.
And therefore, at some level, you could tell yourself, it doesn't all depend on me. And I found it very important to be reminded all the time, it doesn't all depend on me. I haven't got to make this work. I've got to do what I can with the best, you know, the best will and the best effort and the fullest prayer I can. But finally, it's not me.
I'm Mark Labberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. I'm taken by your phrase that it doesn't depend on you, and that there is a drawing of power that is from a source much greater than yourself. And one of the things that's at stake in a lot of the current American political scene, but also I would say political and Christian scene in America, has to do with really competitive visions of power. So let's just talk a little bit about the meaning of that. First, in the context of the Anglican Communion, I want to keep drawing back to that because I think it's quite an interesting point to refer to because of your experience, and also because so many of the listeners, I would think today, may not be people who come from the Anglican Communion. And the way that power is held in the Anglican Communion is, I think, very instructive about power. So, so give us a little history lesson about how power is held and negotiated in this thing called the Anglican Communion.
Right. It's a big question, actually. Yes. I'm tempted to say, how long have you got? I think the answer is that the Anglican Communion developed in some ways out of the British Empire and then had to rethink its identity. In the late 19th century, probably it would still have been the case that worldwide most of the bishops were from Britain, apart from the United States, which was always much more independent. A lot of missions were still heavily dominated by a Western agenda. And bit by bit, from probably the middle of the 20th century onwards, the independence of the different local churches was recognized. Local clergy more and more were coming into leadership positions. Theological institutions were developing. In other words, we watched power being dissolved and diffused in the worldwide family.
And nationalized.
Nationalized, though I hesitate about the word nationalized.
Yes, I think
the idea
of
the national church is a bit of a problem.
Right.
But in practice, yes, that's what it felt like. It felt like the transformation of the empire into the Commonwealth in Britain. And a bit more than that, too, because it wasn't restricted to the old British Empire or British Commonwealth. There were new churches appearing in areas which had never been part
of,
like Latin America and indeed Francophone Africa. Some very interesting stories to be told about that. So gradually, power moves away from the obvious cultural center. Yet the Archbishop remains the senior convener. And that was one of the tensions. A strong sense, as we're constitutionally speaking, that every province, as we call them, every local church in the Anglican family has its own canon law, its own hierarchy, its own operational independence.
Right.
And yet there are certain structures like the 10-yearly Lambeth Conference of Bishops where everybody gathers together, and the influence and sort of, shaping force of the Archbishop, which still preserves some residue of serious power within the Church of England. So at every moment, I think it was important to be aware that you mustn't, I mustn't as Archbishop, revert to colonial mode, that the voices that you're hearing are all worth listening to, that what you have to do is to try and make sure that people genuinely come to a consensus that they can all own. And I used to say sometimes if a decision takes a long time to make, the justification is that perhaps it'll stay made, not unravel straight away, because people have been through the process and owned it. So there's something to be said for taking your time over these things. So those were some of the things that I used to think about.
One of the things that I think is striking, again, from a position outside the Anglican Communion, is this awareness that there are structures and authorities that are both colonial and decolonialized in various ways. I see that both in the American Episcopal experience, but certainly in the Anglican Communion, as I've seen it in many other parts of the world. And I'm moved by the tension that exists between an acknowledgement of the practical, pragmatic power that is necessary in order to govern and rule and guide and shape, and at the same time, how all that is interfused with a deep and genuine spirit of servanthood, which is not about power over, but if anything, power under, and somehow trying to be of whatever genuine agent of of grace you can be. So in the Anglican Communion, or for you personally, how do you hold on to the reality of both of those two things? On the one hand, you know that you're, during the time that you're Archbishop, you have a certain practical political authority. But on the other hand, you're in a communion that's divided, very wounded in various places, and you're wanting to also serve it, not just shape it.
So that, I think, is where it's essential for the Archbishop to be alongside local churches. That's why the traveling, although it could be burdensome and sometimes frustrating, was essential. And I tried also at times to make sure that leaders of some of the other churches would simply have private time with me, that I could, if, say, the Archbishop of Uganda or Ghana were in London, to make sure I had a one-to-one meal with him and a chance just to talk at leisure, to pray together and so on. Times inviting people to Canterbury to do that. So begin by listening, begin by being alongside. Try to make sure that somebody knows they're heard, and then there's a bit more chance that what you say won't come out of nowhere, mm-hmm. won't just come as a bolt from on high. But I used to think quite a bit about what power meant in Christian terms, because it's something we've always had trouble with. And we worship a crucified Lord who upturns our assumptions about power and who exercises power, who makes what you might call a God-shaped difference in all the ways we wouldn't expect. Now, that's a real challenge to any system, any authority. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you have to keep in mind. There's always that divine upturning of your expectations and your way of getting your way.
Right. Well, I think one of the things I've loved about my own experience of the Anglican tradition has been the way that the liturgy is a negotiation of power. So the way that the liturgy is a weekly reinstruction in what power there is, how it's meant to be healthily ordered, how you lay power down, how you take power up. And the liturgy becomes, in that sense, the common negotiating language that redefines the communion. Is that a fair
description? That's a very good way of putting it. And it's something which is explicitly discussed by Richard Hooker, the great Anglican thinker of the late 16th century, where he says the form of worship itself tells you that no one voice does all the work.
Yes, yes.
And he says the point of having, as we call them, versicles and responses, where the minister says one thing and the congregation says another, the point of singing the psalms in alternate verses, Hooker says, well, that's just a symbol of how the church works. No one voice does everything.
Right, right.
And in that sense, yes, the liturgy is a key recognition about power. You don't have a solo piece of instruction.
Right.
You have a formal ritual, but real dialogue.
Right, right. I remember at a time in my life being in a particularly difficult, dark sort of patch, and I found low church Protestantism very difficult because it felt as though I was invited to worship God through the personality of the worship leaders, which was not something I was inclined to want to do then or now. But it was the form of functioning government that was guiding a lot of churches. And it was in that time that a friend of mine was confirmed in the Anglican church. And I remember being so struck by the fact that for me, over the next year or year and a half that I was then part of that congregation, I was so deeply aware that the liturgy was like a pallet in Mark 2 that was carrying me and the community to the feet of Jesus in a way that it required us together doing. And that to me was an enormously important experience of Anglican worship.
I couldn't agree more. I think the sense of being carried at times of a weakness is fundamental to all Christian maturity. And like you, I can remember a period when, for various reasons, things were very tough. It was when I was a graduate student. And I used to go to Holy Communion every day in a church in Oxford because it was just there. It was happening. This was just, you know, you were reminded this is what we do.
Right.
We just come, we pray, we break bread. That's it. Nothing more is required for this moment, but just remember it's there. It's real.
Right. Right.
And for months on end, really, a sense of just resting on that. Somebody once pointed out to me that the Hebrew word for trust literally means lying back on.
Uh-huh. It's a wonderful image. Mm. I remember when I was a graduate student in Cambridge and we went to choral evensong almost every day that it was available because we were aware that it was a unique season of our lives, that we weren't going to live in that place forever, and that this was a great privilege. Mm. But it created also a different kind of rhythm of spiritual practice that for my wife and me was really quite a remarkably important time and carried out some of the same meaning that you're describing. Mm.
I think to get used to the daily round of reading scripture, not according to the bits you like or fancy, but just, again, because it's there, to say the Psalms every day and to become a sort of native speaker of psalm language. Most Anglicans formed in the kind of rather old-fashioned tradition I was formed in. That just gives you a kind of anchorage. And my wife and I now both teach in a a seminary in England. She more or less full-time, I occasionally. And a lot of people there come from very unliturgical backgrounds. And without wanting to force them into a mould that they don't find congenial, one of the things that both she and I feel we want to say to them is, look, just make sure you've got some anchorage. Make sure you've got something more than just your own little personal pot of experience and wisdom to draw
on. Right, exactly. That was part of why the words of the liturgy were so significant to me. Only the biblical words, but the Book of Common Prayer in the sense that when biblical or biblically consistent were words that were transporting of an identity, a reality, an affirmation that was easily lost track of in the midst of everything else.
Very interesting that when the first reforms of liturgy began in the 1960s, a lot of lay people in the church found that some prayers which liturgical experts weren't very keen on were the ones they most wanted to hang on to. There's a prayer in the Holy Communion service called the Prayer of Humble Access, which I can remember the discussion about this in our parish. I was a teenager at the time. And the Prayer of Humble Access, which you say before Holy Communion, we are not worthy even to eat the crumbs from under your table, we say to God. The liturgical experts said, well, we don't really need that. And the lay people said, no, that's for us, that is the key moment.
Exactly.
We've internalized that sense of an unworthiness that's always overtaken by the generosity of God.
Right.
Whose property is always to have mercy.
Right.
A great phrase in the prayer.
Exactly.
And that's an object lesson.
Yes.
The words and the rhythms go deeper than you realize, and the liturgical experts don't always have the right answers. Sometimes the sheer shared experience of the people of God just finds its level.
Right. Well, I do think that this is one of the things that in a lower church tradition that has less liturgy, that there is a tendency to lose track of these common repeated practices. Mm. And while they may be found, and I certainly have had very positive formation through that kind of a context, I'm also aware that there are things that it doesn't bring. Yes, and part of what it doesn't bring is a vocabulary to mind that is evocative in a continuous, ongoing way of these rhythmic patterns that help us re-say again, yet again, and yet again, the same thing, even though our context may change, that affirmation remains the same. It's profound.
That's right. It's again, it's a tension built into being Christian. I think you're telling the same story, the old story of unseen things above.
Right.
In a way, there's nothing new to say.
Right.
At the same time, you are a different person every time you return to this.
Right.
And the Christmas story doesn't change every year. The Easter story doesn't change every year.
Right.
But you change. And therefore, why and how the Christmas story and the Easter story are good news could be a bit different year on year.
Yes. So stepping then beyond the Anglican Communion, you obviously also have a wide exposure to the global church. And I'm just curious, as you think about places and stories of joy and great hope, like the ones that you've referred to, or think about places of particular concern to you, what would be an example of a story of hope and joy and another story that may be a place of particular struggle or challenge that you think is before us?
I guess I could see both of those in somewhere like Pakistan. As I said, I visited there just after a particularly gruesome atrocity against Christians. And the atmosphere was very tense. I had to meet some quite militant Muslim leaders during that period, talk with the Pakistani government, with the Ministry of Religious Affairs in Pakistan. And it's a tiny church in Pakistan. And historically, it tends to be people from the poorest classes who belong to it. So the sense of the helplessness of these little communities in the face of what was often overwhelming local prejudice, whipped up by some very unscrupulous people, that was deeply painful to witness. Though, in fairness, you know, government and lots of Muslim institutions were prepared to be friendly, to be positive, and it's not at all the case that everybody was an enemy to the church, but out in the villages, you know, really tough. But I went to one little congregation in Islamabad, in the capital, and we couldn't get there by car. We had to walk through the back streets of the city, down a kind of labyrinth of little lanes with goats and chickens everywhere and unidentifiable liquids flowing over your feet and rubbish piled up in corners and all the rest of it, and burrowing deeper and deeper into this very, very poor part of the city. And then, like the moment of welcome and transformation when you arrive, this tiny congregation, desperately poor, glowing with faith and courage in the midst of all that.
Amazing.
These are great gifts.
Yes, absolutely.
And since retiring from the Archbishopric, I've been back to Sudan, South Sudan as it now is, yet again in the throes of an unspeakably awful civil war, worshipping with people in the refugee camps, speaking to a little women's cooperative in Juba who had had their entire savings looted in the war a few months before and had simply decided to start again. And there they were praying, working together, basic handicrafts for women in this, again, this very impoverished bit of the city. And also visiting the cathedral at Bor in South Sudan, where 300 people had been killed in cold blood, and seeing the mass grave outside the west front of the cathedral.
Right.
It's in all these contexts that you think, back to what I was saying earlier, yes, this is real. This is, if anything is real, this is real. And when you see people's capacity, people's freedom to love, to celebrate, to give thanks in the midst of that.
It's remarkable.
It actually does make sense. It actually does cash out.
Right. One of the things that I know is an issue in Britain, as it is in the United States, but in Britain in its own particular way, beyond the ecumenical connections and experiences that you've had, has also been, as you were just referring in a way, the interfaith issues, and in particular the Christian-Muslim issues within Britain. How do you see that at the moment, and what are your hopes?
I suppose that was, in a way, one of the most surprising things of my time as Archbishop, the priority that that came to have. So I took up office not long after 9/11.
Right.
And my predecessor had set in motion some dialogue processes with Muslim communities, and I found myself really caught up in that over the years. We had two kinds of initiative. One was local, one was global. Locally, in Britain, we set up something called the Christian Muslim Forum, which was meant to be a network of local associations where people from mosques and parish churches would simply get together, looking at perhaps local community issues that, that had engaged all of them, common interests, and just get to know each other as neighbours. Globally, we had an annual gathering called the Building Bridges Conference, which we held in different parts of the world. We'd invite Christian and Muslim scholars and leaders from a variety of countries to gather for a week, and we'd take a common subject, which might be, let's say, prayer, poverty, death, big, you know, big themes.
Big themes.
And both parties would bring texts from their sacred scripture and from their theological tradition to put on the table so that we could together discuss from the depths of our tradition these large issues. And very, very deep friendships were formed in that context, very deep friendships. Sometimes we'd sit in on each other's acts of worship quietly and tactfully. And it left me with a sense which has never quite faded, that in real dialogue there, you hope to see the face of the other person turned towards God. That doesn't mean that you ignore the gulfs, the difficulties, the real disagreements. You know, there are things I believe to be true, which my Muslim friend does not believe to be true, and vice versa. No way around that. And I'm not relativizing that. But when you see a deeply devout Muslim engaged in prayer, when you hear them talking about their sacred scripture, there's something you can learn. There's some reflected glow.
Right.
And as I say, these events went quite deep. And all through my time, this was an annual event. I would chair this meeting every year, and would always be landed with a rather unenviable task of gathering all the thoughts together at the end of the meeting.
Right, right.
But that meant I had to learn fast, listen hard. Now, in the UK, I think it's a complex position. In some areas, you have Muslim and Christian or Muslim and non-Muslim communities living together without any great issues. Some parts of the country, you have bits of cities which are overwhelmingly Muslim, and that generates its own challenges. You have some areas where the local Church of England school will be overwhelmingly subscribed by Muslim families and children because it's the local school. And sometimes also it's a school they trust because it takes faith seriously.
Yes.
And although we've had, Lord knows, we've had our share of terrorist challenges in the last couple of years, this is a sort of 1 centimeter deep surface of what often is quite serious, quite constructive local engagement. Mm. So I don't despair of that. And there's the new generation of Muslims coming up, being born and educated in Britain, mm-hmm. who see themselves essentially as citizens mm-hmm. of the UK, who want to engage more constructively with their neighbours and their society. Loads of conversations that can be had and mm-hmm. relations to be built. And I think the Church of England has played a quite significant role in that. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes a challenge, and this is often in my mind now, sometimes a challenge to balance that with how we relate to the Jewish community mm-hmm. in the UK, who often feel they're at the receiving end of prejudice from both Muslims and Christians, mm-hmm. and who feel beleaguered in many mm-hmm. ways. So that's, you know, that's another part of the map that you have mm-hmm. to attend to. And that could be a challenge at times. And now that we have in the UK a lot of public concern about resurgent anti-Semitism, I think it's probably more important than ever that the church should be crystal clear about its repudiation of anti-Semitism. So, complicated picture, but I felt very enriched by all those engagements. And one particularly moving and significant event was when I took a group of about a dozen faith leaders, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, Zoroastrian, to Auschwitz. The chief rabbi and I jointly led this pilgrimage to Auschwitz, just for a day. And we built in at the end of the day a time just to sit together and talk about what we'd seen and experienced. And I think for everybody involved, it was, well, of course, any visit to Auschwitz is heartbreaking. But for people coming from a rather different perspective, for whom mm-hmm. that wasn't part of the history, a real challenge, a real straining at the limits of what they could grasp, but a really important moment for building solidarity. Mm-hmm. One of the roles, oddly enough, of the Archbishop of Canterbury can be as a convener, not just for Christian, but for non-Christian mm-hmm. leaders. And it was quite a significant bit of the job, as I understood it, to bring together the leaders of the other faiths from time to time, just informally, just to talk about what was on our minds, what our hopes and fears were.
Mm. Well, Dr. Williams, I want to say how grateful I am that over the course of your life, you have heard the voice of God and sought to be as faithful as you can be to that vocation. And you do bring together so many of the strands that are often divided and held apart. And I just want to say, as a Christian brother and fellow Christian leader, how really grateful I am distinctly for you and for the work that you've done and for your time here at Fuller and for this conversation. Thank you very much.
You're very generous. Thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.